Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Hi, Gary. You're looking lovely, if you don't mind me saying so.
I don't mind at all, Peter.
Ah, off for the goods. We're all in good moods today. Excellent moods, in fact.
What a lovely buttery man you are.
Yes, you're a buttery man as well. One of our chums called you that, and you've been worrying ever since, haven't you?
I have, yes. Right, what are we doing today then, Pete?
Well, we're doing Hugh Trenchard.
Well, he was buttery.
No, he wasn't. He was... I nearly led myself into trouble. He was a difficult man. Why is there controversy about him? Well, it's his aggressive tactics he pursued during his period as commander of the Royal Flying Corps on the Western Front from 1915 to 18. How would you... I mean, Gary, before you came to understand the ways of Great War history, how would you have described him?
Well, he's often depicted as an intransigent bore of a man, at sending his men flying over the lines time and time again, often in near obsolescent aircraft, when more flexible tactics could have reduced the butcher's bill. And as such, he's become a lightning conductor for angst over the losses suffered in the Great War.
Now, he reminds you of somebody else suffered.
Well, it's much the same with Arthur Harris, isn't it? Blamed for the painful bomber offensive over Germany in the Second World War.
With less reason, because the bomber offensive is still quite controversial. But a lot of what Trenchard did has a reason, and he's often bracketed with who else does he get bracketed with from the Great War?
Oh, notably with Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig as the epitome of the stupid general.
Led by donkeys.
Absolutely. Now, we're hoping to show today that this is totally unfair, aren't we? And that there were good reasons for the tactics that he employed.
Yeah, so we'll have a look at his background. Because, funnily enough, his background's great fun, isn't it? A lot of our sources are from... There's a famous biography written in the 50s, which I can't remember at all. The one we used mainly was Boom Trenchard by Russell Miller. So I'll just mention that now, because I know I forgot to put it in the notes, and I'll not remember the title at the end of this.
I just assumed it was Wikipedia.
Wikipedia was your main source.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So when was he born, Gazza? As we like to call you.
He was born on the 3rd of February 1873 in Taunton.
Ooh, did he have a Taunton accent then?
Oh, dear.
No, he didn't. Let's just establish that before we led into the ways of pirates.
His early education was undistinguished. His reports... were marred by accusations that he was clever, but lazy.
My reports at school were often marred by similar things. It's just one of the words wasn't there.
Yeah.
Guess which one?
Lazy?
No, that was there. They never mentioned anything about me being clever.
Now, his youth, it's disrupted by the bankruptcy of his father in 1889.
Sorry, he'd be about 16 now. That's a bad time for your dad to go bankrupt.
Yeah, and also his own inability to spell. Now, it's possible that he suffered from dyslexia.
Or he couldn't be arsed.
No, certainly he still failed to commit himself to the studies necessary to pass into his chosen military career, so... Maybe laziness was part of
well,
it.
Well, you know, dyslexia is a very real thing, but not everyone who says they suffer from it. You can't attribute it to the past before there were a medical diagnosis, really, with any certainty, can you? We often just use modern things about people in the past without really knowing.
That's
whatever the truth is, he was bloody awful at spelling. I know several other people. I wonder if he could pronounce things.
He probably got dates right, though, Pete.
And he could pronounce things, probably.
Now, after failing numerous entrance examinations for Sandhurst, he managed to get a militia commission with the 4-Far and Kincardine Artillery.
That's like the 554-Far, it's only different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very similar.
I wrote a song about this called Backdoor Banging. For the those naughty lumps, a fine body of men.
I'm not entirely sure what the connection is.
Well, it's just the going through the back door, and that is a way of getting a commission when you can't pass the exams, isn't it? And then at last, what happens? It's a big surprise to everyone. What happens? What happens, Gary?
Well, he passes, and in September 1893, he was commissioned into the 2nd Royal Scots Fusiliers, who were based in India.
Now, let's. How does he fit into the officer's mess? And let's start talking about what type of a man was Treacherous, because he seems to almost... His character traits are established quite early, aren't they? What was he like?
Well, he didn't really fit in because of his abrasive character. And in fact, in the mess, he was nicknamed the Camel for his small head, long neck, and habit of grinding inarticulately...
Grunting, I think you'll find that might be.
Grunting, inarticulately.
What would he grind?
Well, we're not going there.
I thought
of at least two things.
All right.
But he would grunt inarticulately.
You're thinking of peppercorns, aren't
you? In answer to any question put to him.
So he was taciturn. He was...
Is that what he was?
Monosyllabic, taciturn, and grunted a lot.
Who does that remind me of?
Not us, either of us. We talk far too much for our own good. So he didn't fit in well. That they used to say people like this were clubbable. We're not clubbable, but I've always thought he was more well and truly clubbable.
Yeah. Not quite sure what you mean, but...
His fellow officers must have often fancied taking a large club to him.
Typically, for the time, he did show enthusiasm for polo.
And a man's game.
And gave a sign of his formidable organisational talents in setting up and running the regimental polo team.
Yeah, that does take quite a bit. You've got to get the polo horses, to get the team established, organise the fixtures, the grounds, the rehearsal.
The sandwiches.
The sandwiches, yes. I'm sure he spent a lot. What sandwiches would you have liked?
Ham.
You like a ham sandwich, don't you? Anyway, So that's one thing. Now, in 1896, the 2nd Royal Scots Fusiliers, they go home back to England, and they're replaced, as in the British Army system, by the 1st Battalion Royal Scots Fusiliers. There's a surprise. And Trenchard wants to stay in India. So what does he do?
Well, he transfers into the 1st Battalion.
Ooh. Now, so he's still in India, but then he gets his first opportunity for active service. And what would that be? It's not the Sudan, because quite a lot of them go to the Sudan, but he gets into the Boer War. And how does he get in? Because I know that you're fascinated by this and want to give us a root and branch to it.
Well, he'd recently been promoted to captain, and he volunteered to rejoin the 2nd Royal Scots Fusiliers.
Because they'd gone from England to Boer land.
Going to be what was known as a casualty replacement. However... The colonel of the 2nd Royal Scots, he rejected the application. And at the same time, the Viceroy of India, Lord Curzon, he was worried about the brain drain from India going to South Africa. So he put a block on any further leavers. And it was only when Trenchard wrote directly to Lord Curzon's secretary...
Who is that? Can't read it, can you?
No.
Let's leave
that. Edmund Ellis.
Oh.
Ha. So,
what rank was he?
Edmund Ellis, I have no idea, but he was military secretary to Lord Curzon, and he made the arrangements for Hugh Trenchard to rejoin the 2nd Royal Scots in South Africa.
So he gets there, what, 1900?
Yeah, he arrives in 1900, and he's selected to command a mounted infantry section formed from the battalion, from where he was detached from the best horsemen in the battalion.
So they picked the best horsemen and made them into this mounted detachment. And, of course, he would be one of the best horsemen because he played...
polo.
Well done.
Thank you. I remember polo involves horses. Now, he was then to add to his command some 300 men of the Australian Bushman's Corps.
Fine body of men.
He'd impressed them greatly by commandeering illicitly.
You mean stealing?
Commandeering illicitly all the gear that they needed from a goods train.
A passing goods train. Well, I presume it was stopped at the station, but yeah. So, yeah, so he was leading them. And he was, what were they employed at? Well, they were on an expedition to suppress Boer raids and the Krugersdorp Railway. Now, he doesn't last that long. There's a vicious little skirmish, isn't there? And what happens?
Well, Trenchard gets severely wounded. Now, at the time, he was furious at the failure of the Ayrshire Yeomanry to push home their attack on some Boer Ridge positions. And you're going to be Sergeant Gilbert Lewis.
He stamped around, calling them damned cowards, and in his anger he went beyond the wall of the farm. I said, "Look out, sir, they hit that cornerstone a minute ago." And he replied, "Shows what damn bad shots they are." And as he said it, he was shot in the chest.
Yes.
How many stories have we heard of that nature? But yes.
He had been shot through the left lung and he had additional spinal complications.
Is that because the spine's near the lung?
Yeah, and it restricted his ability to walk.
So he's pretty comprehensively buggered, isn't he? So he goes, for a time, it seems like his military career's over. He goes back to England, where he's incredibly rude to the person who was put in charge of him, Lady Sausage or something. I'm just doing this to ruin it because I know you'd look this up on Wikipedia.
Lady Dudley.
And you were particularly looking forward to telling me about that. But anyway, he was staggeringly rude to her. And nevertheless, he was sent off to recover at St. Moritz in Switzerland. Presumably they thought that the clear mountain air would help him. But he had another idea in mind when he saw the mountains. What was that, Gary?
Well, he became obsessed with mastering the Cresta Toboggan Run, which, let's face it, that's a really unorthodox route to health and efficiency for a severely wounded man.
Health and Efficiency used to be your favourite magazine, didn't it?
But if you think about it, once in the toboggan, he hasn't really got to use his legs in that.
No, because other people would give him a push-off.
They would. And Fred's moving.
Oh, he's now blocked off the door entirely. So yeah, so once it's gone, you've seen the crest around.
There's no
stopping it. You can't exactly get off. So once he's on the sled and been given a bit of a push off, now what happens to the average? He refuses to do the beginner's thing. He goes straight for the difficult one. He comes off many a time. In one, he has a particularly bad smash-up, and that must have been terrible for him with his injuries. What did the smash-up do?
Well, rather bizarrely, the crash seemed to alleviate his spinal discomfort, while the clear cold air, which you mentioned, did his damaged lungs the world of good. Now, afterwards, he could walk freely after the accident. Not perfectly, not wonderfully well, but he could walk.
So he was well enough to return for a second tour of active service in South Africa. And he goes back in 1901. And he rises to the command of a mounted infantry regiment. They're raising lots of different mounted infantry regiments. We're not going into any detail. Before returning to join, at the end of the war, the 2nd Royal Scots Fusiliers at Aldershot in 1903. I bet they were delighted to see him. Oh, look, it's the camel. Bastard, I hate him. Don't want to play polo. I want to have a nice rest in England. Anyway, so he doesn't stay there long, does he? He's got no future, really. He's never going to rise to the top. So what does he do?
He takes up a career as a tobogganist.
No, Gary, although they could have done. What does he do? What does he do, Gary? Tell me.
He takes the initiative by volunteering for a secondment to command the South Nigeria Regiment to the West African Frontier Force in Nigeria in late 1903.
Now, this is the bit that I thought, when I first heard about this, I thought, oh, we've got to do loads and loads on this because it is the most exciting period you can imagine. It's in some ways, what he's doing is not acceptable these days. What is he doing? It's certainly not what you'd... It's the sharp end of the empire operating against colonial people, as you might say. What's he doing?
Yeah, he's leading small columns against huge numbers of African natives. Now, fortunately for Trenchard, his opponents lacked modern weapons. And sometimes he secured victory by simply setting off fireworks to scare them off.
So this is very much the Blackadder. You're with your Lee Enfields. They might have early. They'd have Lee Enfields, but against people armed with pointed, sharpened fruit and things like that. But in mass numbers, if they get in amongst you, what happens when they get in amongst you? Which battle do you remember?
Well, Island Wilmer is a case in point, which I think is what you're referring to.
It is, Gary.
Now, he was there for a while, Pete. He was there for 6 years, and he played a key part in the mapping and. Pacification of great tracts of Nigeria.
And then what happened? What happens to nearly all British people if they stay too long at that time in Nigeria? Well, in West Africa.
Well, at that point, his health breaks under the strain and he returns to England. In fact, he's got an abscess of the liver, I believe.
Ooh.
Which would have been very painful.
Yeah, have you got one of them?
A liver, yeah.
Now, what next? He's looking for new challenges, and you must imagine he doesn't want to go back to regimental duty. And you can imagine him looking about, and then suddenly he sees a speck in the sky. Well, that's how I'm imagining. What does he do?
Well, it is quite unusual because at the oldest permitted age, he takes up a new challenge, learning to fly aeroplanes. Now, he's never a good pilot. But a flying certificate opened a new world of opportunity.
So he passes.
He passes.
Just.
And he was soon made adjutant of the Central Flying School.
So basically an organisational post, a staff officer, if you like, within the command structure of the Central Flying School. What could he show them from that position?
Well, he's got a domineering character, but he's got great administrative skills, and together they would play a real role in shaping the fledgling Royal Flying Corps, which was formed in 1912.
Now, we better jump on. The outbreak of war comes. I presume he's given an important post.
That was in August 1914.
Was it?
It was. I'm just demonstrating the knowledge there, Pete.
Excellent. Really...
Following the debacle of Fleurs Corselet.
Oh, don't worry about
Let's
that.
Let's not mention Fleurs Corselet.
Well, somebody just did.
Oh, yeah.
What was the date of Fleurs Corselet, Gary?
15th of September to the 22nd of September. Sorry. 1916.
16? You're going for 16 this time.
I'm going for 16 this time.
Right, is he given an important post, or is he given the post he wants? Does he fly off into action? What happens?
Well, he's left behind in command of the Central Flying School.
So he's now, hang on, he's not adjutant anymore.
No, he's commanding. He's 2 years later. But most of the RFC left for active service in France.
So how does he respond? Does he respond cheerfully and with good grace?
Well, he performs his job conscientiously, and he does receive his reward when in November 1914, he took command as a lieutenant colonel of the 1st Wing, as part of the First Army commanded by Lieutenant General Sir Douglas Haig.
We've heard of him.
We have. Now, Trenchard, he's left an account of their briefing for the Battle of Neuve Chapelle, which was held on the 16th of February 1915.
So he's Haig's called him in and asked him what the Royal Flying Corps can do to help in the Battle of Neuve Chapelle. And you're going to be Hugh Trenchard, Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Hugh Trenchard, explaining what you can do.
I tried to explain what I thought they would do in future, besides reconnaissance work. He was interested. Then he said he was going to tell me something that only 3 or 4 people in the world yet knew. In March, we were to launch an attack on the Germans. I was not to tell anybody. He said, "Well, Trenchard, I shall expect you to tell me before the attack whether you can fly, because on your being able to observe the artillery and carry out reconnaissance, the battle will partly depend. If you can't fly because of the weather, I shall probably put off the attack.
Now, we've always been slightly dubious of that, because if you look in Haig's correspondence, it says something like, brief trench shot. But it is a sign. They formed a very close bond, didn't they? These two rather... You can over-exaggerate Haig's inarticulateness, but they were both known or thought to be inarticulate. I think that's probably... And they form a close relationship, don't they?
But whilst both were taciturn, they were both efficient staff officers.
Very, very efficient, yeah. Now, Haig had always been an advocate of aeroplanes, and although he'd been beaten in 1912, that's because he placed too much trust in their reconnaissance and was rather outmaneuvered because of it. And he would support Trenchard through and through, helping him in what is a bit of a dizzy rise to heights, because eventually he's Major General commanding the Royal Flying Corps on the Western Front. And this happens very quickly, doesn't it?
It does, and at one point in the summer of 1915, he's actually promoted twice. He's promoted to full colonel and then Brigadier General. So it's a meteoric rise, rather like my own.
In the army or in civilian life?
Civilian life, obviously.
Now, what is the bedrock of their relationship, would you say, Gaza?
Well, it was Trenchard's grasp that the RFC was entirely subordinate to the requirements of the army.
What's that mean in practice? Because the Royal Flying Corps, I've got to make this clear, is part of the army. It's a corps, like the Royal Army Corps, the Royal Army Medical Corps, about the Royal Artillery. It's a corps. So what was it to do? What it's subordinate, what is it going to do?
Well, it's providing aerial photography to map German trenches.
We've done that.
Track their movements, as well as pinpointing targets such as gun batteries.
And then there's something else they can do with wireless transmitters and a clock code. What else can they do?
Yeah, the use of a simple clock code and wireless transmission would then enable aerial artillery observers to guide the shells onto the target to devastating effect.
So they can locate a target through photography and then destroy it through artillery observation. And that's what they can do. Any other duties?
Yeah, further duties were the contact patrols to chart progress in attacks, ground strafing and interdiction, bombing to try and cut out German rail and road links to the battlefield.
Now, but all of those things, contact patrols, ground strafing, interdiction, bombing, all of them are more aspirations than something that can do that well. But they're trying to do all of them. Most of that is linked to bomb load and aircraft. They just couldn't carry enough bombs to make it worthwhile. Now, Trenchard also realises one great principle, that the Royal Flying Corps must bear any losses to achieve what the army wants. That whatever the army wants, that comes first. They have to get through, they have to do it. Now, what's one of the first challenges to the Royal Flying Corps in the summer of 1915? What happens? What could it be?
Well, it's the advent of the Fokker monoplane with its forward-firing synchronised machine gun, preying on the RFC aircraft in late 1915.
The fuckers.
It's... yes. I'm not saying anything.
Now, does that mean, you know, does that mean they stop flying missions over the lines?
No, Trenchard orders his men to keep on flying over the line despite the Fokker scourge. His only compromise being that formations of aircraft were sent out on missions formerly carried out by lone aircraft.
So this is what we're talking about is the B-2Cs, the Moraine Parasols. These are very, seemingly at the time, the Fokker seemed to, because it had a forward-firing machine gun, they were in essence obsolescent. They were easy prey, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, but, you know, in sending them out together, aircraft could at least try to defend each other.
Security in numbers.
Yes, indeed.
I see. Now, but underpinning everything, let's go back to the basic principle. What is the basic principle?
Well, that losses must be accepted to get results.
And in late 1915, they keep going and the gamble works because a whole new generation of British aircraft arrive in the spring and summer of 1916. Now, we've gone through them. I've been through them several times with you. I remember drawing you a pie chart and an example of what new aircraft can you remember?
Well, I can remember the FE-2B.
So that's a two-seater pusher.
The DH-2.
Single-seater pusher.
The FE-8.
Single-seater pusher.
The Newport Scout.
French single-seater tractor aircraft. Quite a good one, that one.
And your favourite, the Sopwith 1.5 Strutter.
Oh, magnificent beast. Why was it called the 1.5 Strutter, Gary?
Because it had 1.5 struts.
Well, on one wing, on the other wing, it had another 1.5. I've often thought that. Why wasn't it called the 2.5 Strutter? But no, all right.
Now, what they do is they allow the RFC to seize control of the skies above the Somme battlefield.
Why the Somme, Gary? What's
just
that?
At the time when it most mattered, between June and September of 1916.
What happened in September?
Well, September 1916, on the 15th of September, was about the Fleurs Corselet.
Trenchard had an assistant, this was a newcomer to the world of military. It was Maurice Baring, Captain Maurice Baring, who'd been brought in as his sort of adjutant, and he was sort of someone who turned. It said Trenchard's inarticulate grunting, much akin to my own inability to express myself just recently, into sort of beautiful prose, because Maurice Baring was quite a well-known novelist of the time. I mean, no one's ever heard of him now, of course. In fact, he's best known for his book on the Royal Flying Corps. But he came in and he committed a whole exposition of what was Trenchard's relentlessly offensive aerial strategy. And why do I say relentlessly offensive? Well, Hugh Trenchard will explain, and that's going to be you, Gary.
Owing to the unlimited space in the air, the difficulty one machine has in seeing another, the accidents of wind and cloud, it's impossible for aeroplanes, however skillful and vigilant their pilots, however powerful their engines, however mobile their machines, and however numerous their formations, to prevent hostile aircraft from crossing the line if they have the initiative and determination to do so.
What a sentence that is. It's about 400 subclauses. I don't know how you did that. Carry on. Carry on, you.
The aeroplane is not a defence against the aeroplane, but the opinion of those most competent to judge is that the aeroplane, as a weapon of attack, cannot be too highly estimated. On the British front, during the operations which began with the Battle of the Somme, we know that although the enemy has concentrated the greater part of his available forces in the air on this front, the work actually accomplished by their aeroplane stands, compares with the work done by us, in the proportion of about 4 to 100.
So if you got 4 reconnaissance missions for the Germans, the British would do 100. What makes you say those figures exactly, Hugh Trenchard?
Well, he's just made them up.
You think so, do you?
I do, yeah. I mean, it's 25 to 1, isn't it? So it's just made up, I think.
Now, the plan is you have relentlessly offensive patrols. You send all your aircraft, your scout aircraft, that's what we call fighters now, and pushing across far behind the German lines, and you beat back the German aircraft, keeping them as far as possible from the vital front line areas. And behind them you have what were called the core aircraft, the artillery observation aircraft, the photo reconnaissance aircraft, carrying out their missions. And you accept, you don't guard them. What you do is you accept that some people may break through from the forward screen. And then it's a bit like in rugby, a game that you're unfamiliar with. You accept that, okay, if you play the game under the enemy's posts, the other team's post, not enemy, then if they break, they might break out, but you'll win the game. So that was his plan. Now, by this time, what would you say, where would you say Trenchard's standing, summer of 1916?
He's in his element. He's a brash, loud-voiced man. His nickname was Boom.
Is that because he boomed?
That's a bit of a change from Camel. He was intolerant of failure, but nevertheless had a certain panache that let him get away with statements that might seem inflammatory from a lesser man.
Now, you've got an example of this, and this is one of my all-time favourite quotes that I love doing in talks, but I see you've bagsied it.
This is Hugh Trenchard. I'm not asking you to do anything I wouldn't do myself. Just because I'm condemned to ride about in a big Rolls Royce and sit out the fighting in a chair, you mustn't think I don't understand.
Wonderful. That will cause a riot now. It's fantastic.
I feel so sorry for him, sitting in his chair and riding about in his Rolls Royce.
While all these lads are off fighting. Insensitive. That phrase, just it betrays a certain insensitivity in some ways. But the phrases, he said a lot of things like that. He reminds me in some ways of Hunter West and his ability to say things that can be held against him, if you like. But some
of the things he got right, though, Pete.
Give me an example.
Well, one thing that Trenchard developed was a policy of replacing all casualties on the day of their demise. Now, a pool of pilots and observers were held at the base at Saint-Omer to ensure that his insistence on a full breakfast table with no empty chairs were not just empty words. Now, actually, I think that's the right thing to do. Although it seems callous, it's in fact designed to help maintain the squadron morale.
And you're gonna read a quote from Hugh Trenchard. Hugh Trenchard explains it, and do you know what? I think he
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Explains it perfectly.
I always looked on the RFC as a family. I tried to put myself in the others' places and to consider the feelings of those who flew as if they had been my own. If, as an ordinary pilot, you see no vacant places around you, the tendency is to brood less on the fate of friends who have gone forever. Instead, your mind is taken up with buying drinks for the newcomers and making them feel at home. It was a matter of pride and human understanding.
You see, Trenchard has to get his men through these problems. He is telling them, you have to fly over the... What happens if an aeroplane is shot down over German lines? What's the best that can happen to you if you're in an aircraft that's shot down?
Well, the best is that you're taken prisoner.
And the worst?
That you die a whole day.
So there's going to be a lot of casualties. You're flying most of your missions, especially if you're a scout pilot, over German lines. Your core aircraft are carrying out the missions even if the Germans appear? Yep.
Yep, absolutely.
Yep. So what does that mean?
Well, mostly it means that the pilots have to learn to make the best of a bad job. Most of them seem to have understood, or at least accepted, his orders. But the inevitable death toll led to some...
Resentment. That's what I'd call it, if not downright hatred.
Yeah, and what they considered to be a simplistic and brutal approach. And you're going to be Lieutenant Thomas Hughes of 1 Squadron, RFC.
Always one of my failures. He's such a bad-tempered bugger. I love him. Trenchard follows a good military principle of repeating any tactics that have not been actually disastrous, and often those that have, again and again, regardless of the fact that the enemy will probably think out some very good reply until they really are so disastrous that they have to be abandoned. Now, he's missing the point. I'm sorry, but Thomas Hughes, he's a brave man. He's killed in, I think, 1918. He is a brave man, and he fought right from 1914. But he's missing the point, because what happens if they don't carry out the artillery observation and photo reconnaissance? What happens?
The losses on the ground would be magnified tenfold. I mean, the whole point is, as Trenchard understood, they are in support of the actions of the army.
Who are suffering hell on earth on the Somme.
Absolutely. And actually, the tactics had worked well during the Battle of the Somme.
Until?
The advent of the German Albatross D1 in September 1916 signalled that the technological pendulum...
We talked about that before, haven't we?
And it had swung back in favour of the Germans.
So why? Well, let's talk about that. Albatross D1... It's the first, I would call it the first, and many, so when I say I, people call it, I just copied them, the first second generation scout. Not like Trenchard at all. I'm so verbally fluent.
Now, what was different about the D1 then?
Well, it's streamlined. It's much more streamlined than most of it. It's got two machine guns firing through the propeller, and they're proper machine guns. They're not Lewis guns stuck on the front like a DH2. With how many rounds in the drum?
Lewis gun, 47, I think.
Yes, that's right. It's got a powerful engine. I always used to joke when I was speaking in the West Midlands, and I used to say, and of course, it had a powerful engine, much like German cars that have seen the end of the British car industry in the West Midlands. And there's some truth in that. It had an excellent engine. It was fast. And what does it do to every single British aircraft available on the Western Front in 1916?
Well, they're obviously, in a moment, they're completely outclassed.
Now, Trenchard was very quickly aware of this, but he's still determined, he keeps his principle, the Royal Flying Corps still have to do their duty.
Well, also, you can't change the aircraft overnight. You know, you've got to wait for new aircraft to arrive. You can't
and
just change
them. And
what's
the biggest hold-up? The engine. Because you can't just magic up an engine and fit it to an aircraft. It takes months, if not years. I suppose, if you like, he just thinks back to 1915, the Fokker scourge. They've done it before; they'll do it again. Does the Royal Flying Corps have any advantage that you might be able to see?
Yeah, I mean, they've still got a numerical superiority, and the Germans still rarely cross the British front line.
Because they're on the defensive. They don't particularly need to know where British things are. They know they're coming. Yeah, I suppose not. So the Germans are automatically on the back foot in that way, and we have enough aircraft to do it. We could withstand losses, although whether we can withstand crew losses forever and ever. What does Trenchard do? What does he do? There's another threat.
He's not the type of man to bend with the wind. He stands firm and he pushed back. Ooh. The Somme was the first great test for the developing theories of aerial warfare. And despite the new German scouts, the Royal Flying Corps still managed to deliver the services that Haig required.
So despite the losses, they just keep on going. The losses are cruel during the back end of 1916, but everything Haig and Rawlinson and Gough want is provided. The photographs, the artillery observation, it's just painful. What is this? This is one of the great lessons of aerial warfare. What is it? What is that lesson?
Well, that supremacy in the air meant the ability to keep army photographic reconnaissance and artillery observation aircraft above the front, and the question of casualties incurred was almost immaterial.
So they'd carried out those duties. That's why a book I wrote on the Battle of the Somme was called Somme Success. It was an amusing title to me, in the sense that for the Royal Flying Corps, it was a success. They discharged their duties, and it was the moment they came of age as a fighting corps, 1916. Now, as 1917 comes up, what does Trenchard think of the situation, the overall situation?
Well, he knows that the Army Cooperation Squadrons...
That's the artillery observation and photographic, yeah.
They need a better aircraft.
Well, what they got?
Well, they've got the long-serving, but frankly, hopelessly obsolete, BE-2 series.
What does BE stand for, Gary?
Bellerio Experimental.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Now, the first BE-2C, that dates back to June 1914. and after 3 long years of war, it had only been supplanted by variants.
Give me some examples of those variants.
Well, imaginatively, the BE2D, the BE2E, and the BE2G, but they all shared its generic faults and offered no real improvement in performance.
They're minor tweakings, weren't they? Now, the intended replacement, then this illustrates the point we were making early. Does the intended is the, I think it's a reconnaissance REA. Anyway.
It's the REA. It's from the Royal Aircraft Factory, and it's the Reconnaissance Experimental 8.
Mark 8. Now, why can't that be brought in back in the 16?
Well, it's your point about the engine. It's more powerful. But it does seem to be jinxed right from the start. Design work, that had begun early in 1916, and the first prototype emerged as early as July 1916.
And what happens to prototypes?
Oh, exactly. But then there's a shortage of raw materials and myriad other problems which seemed to dog the progress of the aircraft from drawing board until it finally arrived at the front in February 1917.
And from that point, the BE2 series is gradually withdrawn and replaced by the RE8. Although when the RE8s still get out, they still think it's a spinning incinerator. There are loads of rumours it's no good. Actually, it's a good, solid aircraft. And between the two, they serve the British, the Royal Flying Corps and then the RAF throughout the war. Just those two. Now, what about Scouts? What people now call fighters?
Well, it's the same thing. Trenchard's fully aware that he desperately needs to increase both the number and quality of his scout squadrons. The aircraft that had triumphed in the Somme skies in 1916 were seriously outclassed.
So where are the replacements? What are the intended replacements?
Well, it's the Sopwith Pup, the Sopwith Triplane, the Newport 17 and the Spad 7.
Now, they're not really up to it, are they?
Well, no, not really. They can't compete with the combination of speed and powerful performance at all altitudes that's possessed by the Albatross.
So, in a sense, the Albatross has jumped a generation of British scouts. The response, the first response, is not as good as the German Albatross, is it?
No, but there is another generation of British scouts.
When's that coming? What is it? What is it, Gary? What is it?
Well, it's the excellent SE-5A.
What does SE stand for?
I don't know.
Scout Experimental.
Thank you, Peter. What's the A stand for?
Mark A.
Ah, thank you, Peter. What's the 5 stand for?
I don't know.
So there was the SE-5A, the Sopwith Camel, and the Bristol Fighter.
What was his nickname?
Oh, yeah.
Bristol Fighters, so the Sopwith Camel's a lovely little thing, very sharp turning, and the Bristol Fighter's a two-seater fighter.
Yeah, but none of those are going to be on the Western Front in any numbers until after the opening of the Battle of Arras.
Hang on, did you say after the opening?
After the opening, yes.
After the opening. Yeah. So Haig could just postpone the Battle of Arras? None of this 9th of April 1917, we'll make it July. Could he do that?
No, of course not. And what followed at Arras was a tragedy.
Why couldn't he? Because the French, it was actually a diversion for the French, which was happening 14th, no, I can't remember, 16th, 14th, another time, a couple of weeks later or a week later. So it's a diversion. So you can't delay it. What is it then? What is it? What happens?
Well, the RFC aircrew took to the skies knowing that they must die in their obsolescent aircraft.
Many of them,
but the infantry would die in immeasurably greater numbers if the guns of the Royal Artillery were not properly harnessed to their destructive task.
Blimey. I mean, what must those men have thought? What do they need in those circumstances? What sort of man do they need at the helm?
Well, they need forceful leadership, and Trenchard was not the kind of man to evade his responsibilities. He saw the larger picture. He knew that certain missions simply had to be successfully accomplished. And if one attempt should fail, then another effort must be launched immediately, regardless of casualties. Now, this isn't stupidity or bravado. No. It's just a grim military necessity. Nowadays, you call it a reality. And many of the men asked to risk their lives fully understood what they were doing. And you're going to be Captain Bernard Rice of 8th Squadron, RFC.
Most of these great struggles have taken place miles in Hunland, where our people daily go to seek them out. Can you imagine the moral effect of this? But yet more has been done. All these railway centres, billets, dumps and aerodromes are visited daily and nightly, and tons of bombs loosed off on them. Never do they get a minute's peace, and they can't stop us. All his reserve defences are photographed several times per week, so we know just what he's doing. We've been working in close contact with the artillery and infantry. The infantry always feel that they are being watched over. Indeed, a plane goes over first and bombs the points they are held up at, signals to headquarters where they have got to, and generally looks after their interests. That's things like contact patrols and ground strafing. He's slightly exaggerating here the effect of some of these things, but they're nevertheless trying to do all this. He carries on. Another plane watches for hung gun flashes and immediately on seeing any signals down positions, etc., by wireless to our gunners, who proceed at once to silence them, being corrected onto the target, the meanwhile, by the plane. We have frequently swooped down and cleared a trench with our machine guns. That's the ground strafing. All this, of course, has cost us some casualties. And the key words, but it is worth the price. And what a brave man, because they are. It's their lives on the line for other people's. So this is courageous soldiers trying to make the difference. And you've got a Trenchard goes round all his squadrons, most of his squadrons, trying to boost morale. Reminds me of Montgomery and people like that, and make a big fuss of them in the Second World War. But Trenchard did it in the First World War. But his visits have quite an impact, sometimes not entirely as he designed, owing to his unique personality. And you're going to be Major Sholto Douglas of 43 Squadron, Royal Flying Corps.
Trenchard often came to visit us at Trezines, particularly during the period of our heaviest casualties. Although it was partly as a result of his aggressive policy in the air that we were having those shocking losses, it must not be thought that he was unaware of or indifferent to what was happening to us. Trenchard was very deeply concerned about that, but it did not change his opinion about what should be done. And that some of us should come to feel that he was wrong in some of his ideas is another matter altogether. The effect that Trenchard's visits had on the morale of those in the squadrons was almost magical. He was a tall man of a commanding presence, which was coupled with a personality that was extraordinarily inspiring.
Yeah, I'm not sure about extraordinarily inspiring. He could be quite a difficult bugger. And there was lots of interaction going on between the officers of the unit he met, the somewhat abrupt, inarticulate and rude Trenchard, and his charming, urbane assistant, Captain Maurice Baring, who we talked about earlier. And Baring develops, it's hilarious to my mind, he develops a series of unofficial punishments so that if Trenchard was overly abrasive, i.e. told everybody what they could do, he would punish him. And I'm going to be Lieutenant Thomas Marson of 56 Squadron, Royal Flying Corps. Famous unit. That's McCudden's unit, isn't it? The aggrieved party was always rung up and informed the general behaved very badly today. He had punishment number one all the way home. He almost cried for his pipe, but I was adamant. I had it in my pocket, but I said I could not think what he'd done with it. At dinner, he was very penitent, and so he was allowed to find his pipe afterwards. I think he's really sorry and will be better now. And I just love the idea of him being this bad-tempered, in some ways horrible, blustery man being treated like a child by this.
Yeah, I mean, it might have been a joke, but the combination of the committed energy and direct methods of the overly blunt Trenchard and the sophisticated wit of Baring.
That's very wet. How I did his pipe is sophisticated.
And it did a great deal to maintain a good relationship between the RFC headquarters and the hard-pressed squadrons in the field during Bloody April.
Bloody April 1917, the Battle of Arras. Now, new scouts do arrive in the early, so too late, but June, July, they start to arrive. And the air war from then on, it's more in an equilibrium, isn't it? I said that because I knew you wouldn't be able to.
I would have said balanced.
You're not Maurice Baring by any chance. The new types of aircraft on both sides from then on are broadly equal. So you get the Fokker D7 arriving, you get the Fokker triplane. On our side, you've got the Spad, you've got the Camel, you've got the SE5. There's not much, the Sopwith Dolphin. There's not much difference from now to the end of the war, and it's all a lot less fraught. How do they do during the Third Battle of Ypres? That follows
well,
on.
They do well. They continue to perform their many roles, and with increasing attention to the ancillary tasks of bombing and ground attack.
That's what earlier on Bernard Rice was talking about. It's still not that effective because you can't carry many machine gun bullets and you can't carry many bombs. They're often only the little 25 pound bombs. Now, what changes in 1918, Gary? Why does everything change?
Well, the defeat of Russia, plus the Germans, the Americans joining the side of the Allies.
The Germans join the Allies, hooray!
That means that the Germans are forced to launch a major attack on the Western Front in the spring of 1918.
Before now, the Americans
they're trying to secure victory before the millions of American soldiers.
Now, that means that the Germans now have to get their reconnaissance and artillery observation aircraft across the line. Their scouts have to stop the Royal Flying Corps reconnaissance aircraft. It's sort of turned
it's
around a bit.
It's role reversal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's role reversal. So who's got to do all this now? The Germans have to do the artillery observation, infantry contact patrol, low-flying ground strafing. The German, what does it mean overall about the German Air Force? What are they no longer? They're not on the...
Well, they're not on the defensive. And once the offensive begins, the German aircraft will be needed more than ever for artillery observation duties.
Now, so at this point, this is a critical point. What happens then? Is Trenchard left in charge?
Well, at this point, he's recalled to London to take up the position of Chief of the Air Staff. Now, his replacement was Major General John Salmond.
I don't think that makes much difference. Salmond's very much one of...
Absolutely. And he had no intention of changing the priorities of the RFC.
But something else happens, doesn't it? 1st of April 1918, what else happens?
Well, at the height of the German spring offensive, great timing... The Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service had to suffer a root and branch reorganisation that turns them upside down and inside out.
Why?
Well, following the Gotha bomber raids on London in the summer of 1917, a public inquiry headed by the South African soldier politician Lieutenant General Jan Christian Smuts had made a series of recommendations that looked far into the future, certainly well beyond the reality of the situation of 1917 or 18.
So what does he basically put... it's difficult to explain. I don't agree with Smuts and I don't agree with what was done.
He considers that aircraft will soon be the prime means of waging war and that they'd eclipse the forces of land and sea. And he wanted to create a new force, the Independent Air Force, to carry out strategic bombing of the German industrial heartlands. Now, he believed it had to be independent to ensure that its operations were not sublimated beneath the routine operations demanded by the army.
And at a stroke, that sort of endless argument between what the army needs and what the IR is half the rouse in the high command in the Second World War. They're delineated there. But that's not all he proposes, and it's the next thing that's quite weird. Well, for the 1st of April 1918, what is it?
Well, he proposed that the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service should be amalgamated to create one air force bound together with one command system, a single supply system, and under the overall control of an air board and staff.
Now, Trenchard, how does he react?
He's completely mortified.
So what does he say?
He says, "I thought that if anything were done at that time to weaken the Western Front, the war would be lost, and there would be no air service, united or divided. I wanted to unify it, but later on at a more suitable opportunity."
It didn't happen. It was the RAF was formed on the 1st of April 1918. How does he do it? We're going to glide past this because, in a sense, his career burns out a bit. How did he do back in London as Chief of the Air Staff?
Well, he's appalled by the prevalence amongst his political masters of both simplistic air policies and rampant intrigues against his old chief, Haig.
Oh, he likes Haig.
Well, he's certainly supportive of him. And
about his personality? How does he get on with the Air Minister, Lord Rothermere?
Well, the situation becomes untenable. So
why?
That tells you. Well,
they're both natural autocrats, aren't they? They're both bastards.
Yes. And Trenchard stands down, I think, around April 1918, and he's replaced by Major General Sir Frederick Sykes.
Who had been deeply unpopular in the RAF, which is quite interesting. In the Royal Flying Corps. Now, after a short break, Trenchard was then appointed to command the Independent Air Force, which had been created on the 6th of June 1918 as part of these reforms. Now, Trenchard, he does a root and branch rethink into the targets to be tackled by the bombers. What does he think would be best?
Well, he does consider the possibility of focusing on key German industrial towns, thereby destroying them one by one. Despite the potential of the concept, he felt that it's simply not feasible.
So he thinks about it, but then he turns against it. Why not?
Well,
are you going to tell us?
I'm going to tell you what he said. Hugh Trenchard says, "It was not possible with the forces at my disposal to do sufficient material damage so as to completely destroy the industrial centres in question, even had the force been larger."
In other words, the aircraft and the numbers. I mean, these aren't Wellingtons or Lancasters or super bombers of that sort. These are little DH-9s and Vickers, what's the one, Handley Pages and things. Even the Handley Page could only carry a derisory thing compared to a Wellington or a Lancaster. Now, so he decides not to focus on one city at a time. So what does he do?
Well, he decides that a scattergun approach to targets is far more effective because of the limited forces available at the time.
Explain it in more detail, Hugh.
Hugh Trenchard says, "By attacking as many centres as could be reached, the moral effect was first of all very much greater, as no town felt safe. And it necessitated continued and thorough defensive measures on the part of the enemy to protect the many different localities over which my force was operating. At present, the moral effect of bombing stands undoubtedly to the material effect in a proportion of 20-1, and therefore it was necessary to create the greatest moral effect possible."
Now you,
I have no idea where 20-1 comes from.
Are you saying he's not? His statistics are made up. But this is the second time you've expressed doubt.
Where does it come from? I have no idea where he's.
What he means? I take it as mean the moral effect is far more important. He also resolves that they should attack. I'll just deal with this before we discuss this point. They should attack airfields, German airfields. Why?
Well, it's a vicious game of tit for tat to prevent the Germans bombing his own airfields out of existence.
So you get them first.
Get in there first.
Now, what's this business about moral effect? It's a work in progress, the whole thing of strategic aerial bombing, isn't it? How much damage do you think they do, the bombs?
The damage caused by the tumbling bombs is often not very serious. Although the raid certainly forced a significant expenditure of scarce German resources to try and fend off the bombers.
So what you mean is they have to put scout squadrons on duty at home, and as they don't know where the Germans are going, they can't focus them, so they're spread out across in the Rhineland mainly. But so they've got to have a lot of resources to defend their things.
Yeah, as Trenchard thought, the main effect of the raids was a disruption of production as factories suspended their work, and that had a moral effect amongst the civilian population.
So what you mean is when the railways stop running, the iron and steel factories switch off their Bessemer furnaces, which take half a day to switch back on, factories stop work, when those alarms go, the air raid sirens, it causes panic and a morale effect, and generally that does more damage to production than the actual bombs.
Yeah, and the time for long range strategic bombers would come, but it wasn't in 1918.
No, it's 1914. Some other time.
Some other war.
Well, we know when it was. It was in the Second World War. And he finishes his job there. It's in a sense, it's always, because he was the great teacher of Army Air Cooperation, and yet he's put on strategic bombing, which he's not at that point. He doesn't think it's ready for it, is it? And it's a bit sad for his career in the First World War. In the end, he's almost a diversion of bombers from where he thinks they should have been bombing the German rear areas for tactical purposes as opposed to strategic. Now, so the war ends. What happens to Trenchard? We're not dealing much on this.
Well, post-war, Trenchard once again appointed as Chief of the Air Staff in March 1919. But it's in a climate of severe budgetary cuts, and he led the fight to preserve the independence of the RAF. He defended the funding and pressing to employ the RAF in various colonial conflicts to justify their existence.
This is bombing Iraq, villages in Iraq and things like that. It's not entirely nice, but it's. He also, what else does he do? He shows his initiative in a couple of other things. What else does he, things that have existed until quite recently or even today?
Well, he founds the RAF College at Cranwell, the Aircraft Apprentice Scheme, and the Reserve Auxiliary Air Force, and he became the first Marshal of the RAF.
I remember that the people, when they chose their ranks, they said, it sounds like Lilliput. It sounds normal to us, AF Chief Marshal and all the rest of it, but in those days, people used to say, what is this? Ludicrous titles. Anyway, he did become first Marshal of the RAF. What was his thinking? Had he changed his thinking?
Well, he pushed the primacy of the bomber.
So that is a change.
Yeah, he believed that the UK could only be defended by threatening the homelands of the aggressors.
This is the idea the bomber must always get through.
Yeah, he didn't really appreciate the defensive strength that modern fighters offered against bombers. And he also neglected the whole area of army cooperation.
That's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that had been the centrepiece of his years on the Western Front. It's very strange.
So, it's strange. And that's what... He is, in part, responsible for the RAF's failure to address army cooperation in 1940, when the British Army performs not very well. How long does he last?
Well, he stands down in 1930.
And is that the end of him in public life?
No, he went on to act as Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police from 1931 to 1935.
And our chums in the police will remember he had quite an effect, the Trenchard years. What about in the Second World War?
Well, he would be an unofficial Inspector General to the RAF.
Turning up and shouting at people.
And then leave. He died on the 10th of February 1955.
Now, Gary, we've talked about this during this podcast. What do you think of him? What is your personal view on Trenchard? How does it come across to you?
Well, he might have been a difficult and intransigent man, but he had a real claim to be considered the father of the RAF. And actually, a lot of the things that he did were right. You did have to support the army in the way that the RFC did. And it was important to get the photographs and to support the artillery. Without it, the losses on the ground would have been enormous. Enormous as they were, they would have been even larger.
So it's a hard job and it's a cruel world.
It is, and somebody has to do it.
Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?